Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and this is Pastor Fred. Welcome. Welcome to Perspectives on the Bible, and I want to welcome you again for coming in. I'm very happy today because I've managed to sort of rearrange life so that I can be with you on these programs more often. You know, we started the programs, and we're doing great guns, and then life intervenes. You know, this particular program is about families and about whole persons, and we're going to be talking about that for at least a good part of the program. I'd like to introduce it by saying that the reason I chose the topic, life, family, and whole persons in relationship to being an active member in the Christian church is because in my own life and in the life of the people I love the most, this is the key to everything. And that is, how can we be whole people, complete people? And how can I'm an army chaplain. How can we be all that we can be, all that God wants us to be, all that God gave us the potential to be, all that we are capable of being? And as a family, I think most of us want whole families, complete families, wholesome families, places of security, and places which we call home, and we say that with a deep affection. And I would suggest to you, and I'm going to try to show it throughout this program, that a relationship to the Christian church, an active participation in the Christian church as a Christian, is a key, foundational, a fundamental principle, is something that you must do in order to be those things, namely, a whole, a complete person, to be all that you can be, all that God meant you to be, and all that God gave you the ability to be, and to be gathered together in a family to which you contribute wholesomeness and wholeness. I'm Pastor Fred. You're listening to Perspectives on the Bible. Please stay with us. I hope we can have some callers in today. I don't have any screeners. I'm going to try something later on, if you stick with me, to try to do it. I won't be able to answer you if you call me now because I'm just not ready. But I hope we can do that. If I have any listeners out there who'd like to call in, we'll give you the number. Maybe you can call in. Maybe you can't. But if you can, I'll try to talk to you about mainly the topic, wholesomeness, a whole familyness, and whole personness. Let's begin with our opening song. We have a great song, Brothers of Faith song. I play it every week. It's really a up-tune. You know, it's an up-tune type of thing, and it's a lot of fun. So let's start with that, and then we'll be back with it. It's about 50 seconds long, so stay with us. Hello, this is Pastor Fred. I'm back. Thank you for staying with us. I just had a little episode, family episode, wonderful episode, just to think about it. At home, that's where I broadcast these from. My wife was with me. We're both together. And she didn't know I was on the air, so she came up the stairs and she started talking to me. It was wonderful. And, you know, you can get worked up about that. Well, I'm on the air. You know, you can get it into a big switchboard thing and I'm on. But why do that? Why do that? If you heard it, good. I'm happy because you know that I'm real. And otherwise, you know, it's a little, it's not even a picadillo. It's just, it's an inconvenience for a few seconds. And I think, to be honest, I might have been a person who would get worked up about that in the past. But, you know, I don't do that anymore. It's not important. It's not important. Peace is important. Tranquility is important. Security is important. Love is important. Relationship is important. That's what really counts. Well, I'd like to begin our program with the Office of Matins. It's a short service. I'm not going to do the entire service, but in the Lutheran Church, we follow what's known as the hours of the day, and it comes from the time when church was everything, when monastic life was a very big part of everyone's existence, and when people were encouraged to pray all the time. You know, today I find it quite amusing that liberal people and atheist people and agnostic people who want nothing to do with Christianity go gaga and about Islam, and they pray five times a day. Well, they don't pray five times a day. They're supposed to pray five times a day, just like Christians are supposed to go to church every Sunday. They don't. You know, I don't know why everybody's gaga about these people who are supposedly praying their devotions five times a day. Or I don't understand why people are all gaga about, well, this is Asaram, and this is this, and this is whoever, the different festivals and sacred days. You know, all the time, every time I hear anything about a Muslim holiday from the secular press, it's always the sacred day of Asuhuba, and the sacred, the holy, and the sacred holy everything. But when they talk about Easter, they talk about the Easter Bunny, and when they talk about Christmas, they talk about Santa Claus. Now, not to disrespect Islam. Now, I have nothing to say about Islam. Nothing. I'm talking about the press here and about the way in which people who claim nominal Christianity, I don't like the phrase, but cradle Christians, you know, born into a Christian family, but they've never come to a relationship with Jesus Christ. They talk about other religions as though they're better. And, well, if you think it's better to be a Muslim, then be a Muslim. If you think it's better to be a Hindu, then be a Hindu. But don't go trashing everything in your faith if you claim to be a Christian. And please don't live as a non-Christian and claim to be a Christian and give disgrace to all of us. So, okay, in the old days of the monasticism, we were encouraged to pray many times a day. I even forget how many times a day. I can tell you. Let me look at the back of my book here. I have a little book in front of me. We were praying. The first office of the day was called Prime. That was I think that was very early in the morning. There's an order of service and worship for that. And then there was an order of service called Terce. That was the next order of service in the monastic orders. And don't forget, monasticism was very, very big, huge thing in the Middle Ages. Thousands and thousands of people were very safely involved and very well involved and very productively involved in monasticism. And I can have a whole entire series of programs on monasticism. A lot of people want to trash monasticism, but I would make the claim, I think that any reasonable scholar would uphold it, that the foundations of all of Western Christianity are preserved and established through the institution of Christian monasticism, which preserves Greek and Roman culture and literature and science, and mixes it together in the Christian faith in a wonderful synthesis and synergy, and then promotes scholarship and the advancement of health and sciences and medicine, writing and literature and music through the Christian church, and mainly through the institution of monasticism. So when you look at colleges, universities, hospitals, healthcare, literature, the arts, plays, drama, any kind of anything to do with our culture, it is directly attributable to the Christian church and to the fact that the Christian church preserved it. Now, I'm going to go there because I'm just being led in that direction. You have to look at the idea that you have Greek culture in Greece. Of course, they do their thing, they do great things, and they build the Parthenon and the Acropolis and all that good stuff. And then they decline. We're not going to deal with the Persian Empire. It's sort of Western, Eastern. That's Iran, and we could deal with that too. It's a great, great story, but I don't really have it right now, other than to say that at one time, the Persians were also predominantly Christians in the pre-Muslim era. In the pre-Muslim era, if the Iranians would have honesty with themselves, they would acknowledge in their own history the very, very key and foundational core basis of the society comes from Christianity pre-Islam, pre-700 AD. Anyway, we're dealing with Western culture now at this point. The Roman Empire falls down. Let's just guesstimate, because you can get me stuck on a particular date, around 490 AD in the West, in Ravenna and all that kind of stuff. And everything's a shambles. The empire extends all the way from Britain, France, and Spain, and Portugal, all of the northern countries, Germany, and so on, and then Italy and like. And that all collapses. Imagine it this way. I live in an area where the density of population is about 25,000 people per square mile. 25,000 people per square mile. And in that density, we have a great need for organized living. In other words, 25,000 people cannot live together without organization. So we have to have government. We have to have county government and town government. And we need to have local police departments, local fire departments, local administrative departments within the government. We need local garbage pickup. We need local street cleaning. We need, recently we had a storm here in the Northeast in October. The leaves were still on the trees, and the snow was so heavy, and the leaves were still on the trees, that enormous branches, and this is a very wooded area in northern New Jersey, so branches and whole trees and enormous, in one day, enormous damage was done by this storm. Very minor storm in many respects, but the weight of the snow, probably tens of thousands of trees fell, thousands of homes were, maybe even tens of thousands of homes were damaged, power lines were down, telephone lines were down, cable lines were down, whole entire 40-foot trees were lying across the streets, and chaos ensued. You couldn't go anywhere, you couldn't do anything, you didn't have any power, couldn't get to the store, you couldn't get to gasoline, the streets were impassable and dangerous. Well, the organization of government, which everybody likes to lambast it, but the organization of government existed to solve that problem, and they did. The police department went out and protected us from getting electrocuted or to running into trees unknown to ourselves. The fire departments were out putting out fires. The public works departments were out cleaning up the trees and the branches. The privately owned cable vision and telephone companies and power companies were out reattaching the lines and reestablishing power, setting up generators and putting everything back, putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, so to speak. All these people who did all these things during the storm were being paid. They were being paid money. They had jobs. And they didn't do it because they loved me or love you. I mean, it doesn't matter that they loved me and love you. It doesn't matter that they were saying they hated me. But the point is that they did it for money. They did it because they have to have a life. They have to have a living. They have to pay their health insurance. Okay, something happened with the connection there, so we'll have to figure out what it's all about. I don't know how it happened, but okay, we're reconnected. I think we're running here. Okay, yes, we are. Okay, so these people who did all this work for us, they did it for money. Now, if you want to know about the collapse of the Roman Empire, you have to imagine that in the situation I just described to you, the money dries up. There's no money. And there's nobody out there able to pay. And so if I have a little gold in my basement, maybe I can pay you a little gold, you know, and you'll maybe clean up my tree. Maybe if I have a little silver, you'll clean up my garbage and so on. But otherwise, I'm left on my own because the money is no longer being honored. Nobody wants dollars. Nobody wants anything to do with what used to be the government. And everything falls into disarray and into confusion, disorganization, and chaos. And to each his own. And ultimately, we imagine in the situation I just described, that town under that storm would break up into the people who had guns and the people who didn't have guns. Those who had guns would be on their front lawns protecting their property from marauders, protecting their property from people who wanted to steal their furniture or steal their television sets or steal their food, because everything is in disarray and chaos. Well, when the Roman Empire collapsed, there was another great organization to which everybody belonged, which was, or almost everybody belonged, which was the Christian Church. And the Christian Church was a very highly organized structural organization with a hierarchy of up-down management and side-to-side management. It had places, it had security, it had buildings, it had administrators, it had money, it had the ability to establish order. It even had an army, so to speak, in terms of its many, many congregations and many, many people. And so in place of the destroyed empire, the Christian church, not immediately, but eventually becomes the new empire, the new organizing principle in a destroyed, a disarray, confused, and disorganized Europe. And from that, monasticism, which is the gathering together of people voluntarily in a particular place in order to do work in common, to work together on the fields as a family, although not related, but they all worked on the fields. So they would gather the sheep, they gathered the cows, they gathered the grain, they preserved seeds. You know, a lot of people think, oh, well, farming is a... No, you see, the monks had to preserve seeds. They had to go and make sure that the seed was still available. Seed is not automatic. You know, if you let a corn crop just fall into disarray, it's not going to produce much corn the next year, and then the third and fourth year is going to produce no corn at all, and everybody's going to starve. You have to harvest the seed as well as harvest the fruit. That applies to fruit trees and grains and everything like that. And that fell not to the government. It's amazing. And now the monastic communities, the monks, and the churches and the local church communities take over the functions of government, including agriculture, husbandry, preserving of seeds, caring for the sick and the needy, the downtrodden, the homeless, health care is taken care of the church, any education of children is taken care of by the church. It doesn't happen immediately, but it evolves that way because the only structure that's left is the church. And so the church takes over, and through monasticism and the scholarship of monasticism as well. This is a complicated topic. I could take a whole year to teach this in college. But through the scholarship that establishes, they with these places where there were libraries, there was no librarians because nobody was paying. And the people were coming and not stealing the books to read them, but taking the books to burn them for fuel because there was no fuel for their fires in the winter. And the people were coming and tearing off the stones of the buildings, not because they hated the library, but because the stones were already quarried and they were already cut and they were already perfectly shaped for the building of their houses. Why house these dead books when we can barely make a living, and so we'll steal the stones, we'll steal the bricks, we'll steal the books, we'll take the stones and the bricks to build our little hovels, and we'll use the books to burn our fires. And so the monks went in and were able to retrieve these books and protect them and take them into the monasteries, not as an act of thievery, but as an act of protection to protect the libraries, the great ancient libraries of the Greeks and the Romans. And so, and then jurisprudence, you know, who's going to be the judge? Who's going to be the giver of justice? Well, corruption is everywhere. Warlords are everywhere. Every kind of violence is everywhere. As I said, who has the guns has the power, and who has the power has the say. Well, the church has moral power, has moral authority and organization, and in some respects it has guns. And so the local bishops become the judges. They become the masters in some respects of the militia of the local people. Anyway, people look to the monasteries, the walled communities, for protection against marauding rangers and bandits and those who want to steal their grains and crops, their fields and their cattle and their children. Some of the things that happened was serfdom or enslavement by the local warlords who were former Roman soldiers or criminals or whoever they might have been, who were released out of prisons that no longer have jailers, and they're now forming bands of marauding criminals, and they're running around stealing children for sex and for their wives and stealing children for slavery in their households and so on. It's all a huge chaos is going on. And it's the Christian church that is there to protect and provide. It doesn't do a perfect job, but it's the only institution that's there, and it does a very, very, very good job, a commendable job. I cannot think that we would have Western civilization in any form today if it wasn't for the Christian church in Europe. And so the Christian church preserves the books, preserves the and preserves the knowledge of the books. You know, architecture, literature, trigonometry, geometry, algebra. That's all preserved and by the churches. Languages, Latin, the philology of languages, the writing, the ability to write. Quickly, when there's no education any longer, people devolve within 20, 40 years into being totally illiterate. They can't even write any longer. But the monks preserve writing. They preserve education. They preserve printing. They preserve the ability to be educated. And how do they perpetuate themselves? Well, the monks go out into the communities, you know. So you're John and Jane down in town number A or town number B, and it's 40, 60 years after the destruction of the empire. Maybe it's 500 A.D. The local monk comes by and he says, "Listen, you've got some children here. Mainly they were interested in boys, and it isn't about pedophilia. That was just their culture. And if it was a girl, it could be a nun. They could go to the nunnery." And the local monastery would say, "Listen, if you want to, bring your children to us. We'll take them in, maybe at 5 years old or before. Up until that time, we'll give you some food. We'll give you some stuff. We'll help you out a little bit. But maybe at 5 years old, you'll bring your child to the monastery, and we'll take the child in. The child will be washing dishes and scrubbing floors, but the child will have clothing, which it doesn't have now. The child will have food, which it doesn't have now. The child will have security, which it does not have now. The child will get an education, which the child is not getting now. The child will have whatever form of health care we have in the monastery, which the child is not getting now. And so it's not that we want to steal your children, but if you want a better life for your children, let them come to the monastery at about 5 years old. They can, maybe they'll be choir. They'll be in the choir." There was a whole work ethic of bringing children to the local monastery. It still exists in northern England, by the way. And the children would sing in the church choirs as a job. And in return for the job, they would get clothing, they would get food, they would get education, they would get health care, etc. It was work for service, you know, service to service, a barter system, so to speak. Worked out well. And the great artisans, the great masons, the great painters, and all these people, all of them have a direct relationship to the church. And in the earliest forms of that, and the most simple forms of that, it was families preserving themselves. Local farmers, for instance, after the fall of the empire, were afraid of marauding people who would come by and burn their houses and steal their goods, their cattle and their sheep. And so they would live very close to the monastery, which was usually a walled enclosure. And what happened then is when the outrider or the people, the lookouts, would announce that the marauding vandals or the Huns or whoever it was going to be, or just local bandits, were going to come into the area, the farmers would be so close to the walls that they would put their sheep inside the walls, they would put their cattle inside the walls, the few cattle they had, the few sheep they had, they would grab everything they possibly could that they owned, and they would go inside the walls, they would lower the gate, and the monks and the militia of the local town, which were connected to the monastery, they would defend the local farmers against these marauding bandits in a disorderly and disorganized society, which eventually evolves, as you know, into the great lords and knights, and then the dukes and the barons and the royalty, which are, they stem out of and they come from the monastic church-centered towns, which still exist after the fall of the empire. Now, that's a very quick, you know, I gave you the whole thing in about 25 minutes, but and you could take a whole course. It's a very interesting story. But what I'm basically saying is that Christianity is more than just doctrinal, it's more than just teaching. It's more than just a philosophy. Christianity, the whole thing, not just Christian faith, that's one thing, that's one part of it. But Christian practice, Christian thinking, Christian values, and Christian culture is the all-encompassing phrase that we would use, is more than just saying, "I have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ." I mean, that's fine. But historically, it's more, and I think in the present, we're not doing ourselves any favors by not emphasizing and understanding that Christianity and the Christian church is big. people of Jesus Christ. It's the core principle of our personal life and individual development and spiritual life. Here we go again with this connection business. Okay, we're having some little running with the Skype here. They keep connecting and disconnecting, but I think we're going to get through that okay. Let's take a pause here. I think we've done enough of that for now. And see if we can play a little music. I have a great song here. Let me see which one we want. I play the same ones every time. You know that. But they're a lot of fun. And I hope you enjoy them. I do. We did the introduction, which was Hope, Faith, and Courage. But there's a great one which I like to play every week. And it's Jacob's Ladder. It's a real jazzy tune. It's about 3 minutes and 15 seconds. Jacob's Ladder. It's an old tune. It's a popular tune. And it has this real nice jazzy sound to it. So let's listen to that, and we'll be back. Stay with us, Jacob's Ladder. Isn't that a great song? I just love that song. You know, Jacob's Ladder, the reference to Jacob's Ladder, which he, remember he falls asleep and he has a vision of the ladder with angels ascending and descending on the ladder between heaven and earth. And he wakes up and he says, surely this is the place of God, Beth-El, the house of God. And it's a reference to getting in connection with God and how Jacob has to get in connection, not with himself, but primarily he has to get in connection with his God, the Lord Yahweh, Elohim, Adonai, the great things, among others, the Old Testament designation of the God without a name. Okay, now I want to get back just quickly to the idea of the orders of worship. The first one is prime. That's the first one in the first part of the day. I'm sorry to have dropped off of that. We got involved with monasticism, as you can tell, one of my favorite topics. I do want to thank you. I love talking to you. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. I know it's a one-way conversation at this point, but visiting with you and sharing with you and having conversation with you is a lot of fun. I don't know if I change anybody's mind, and maybe I really don't necessarily want to, I guess, but I do want to inform. I do want to bring information. I do want to talk about that which I feel is overlooked, and if you look at it, it may become important to you for your understanding of who you are and what you are and what you're doing in life. First order of worship for the Christians, prime. Second order of worship for the Christians is terse, T-E-R-C-E, terse. And the third order of worship for the Christians is sext, S-E-X-T, sext. I think that's like about, 6-7 o'clock in the morning, I think that is, they say that. And then the next one is known, N-O-N-E. It sounds like about 9-ish. I think that's correct. I think that's maybe something about that time. I'm not exactly sure of what time. You can look that up on the internet. I can't do everything for you. But look it up. And then, of course, Matins is in there. Matins is in that service somewhere. I skipped it. Then there's the office of Vespers. And then there's the office of Compline. There's the office of Compline, which is the last service of the day. And then there's an order of itinerary, which you pray before traveling. We're going to share with each other the order of Matins. I have it in front of me. I'd just like to share it with you. I'll read both my part, which is the speaker's part, the pastor's part, or the leader's part. It doesn't require a pastor. The leader's part, and then the responsive part. So there's two parts. And then I'll go all the way up to, I'll give you the titles. The first part we're going to do is called the versicles. Those are call and response. The pastor says, O Lord, or the leader. It doesn't have to be a pastor. It can be anybody. Father of the house, mother of the house, oldest, youngest, whoever. O Lord, open thou my lips. That's the first phrase. Second phrase is repeated from the audience or the group around the table or whoever they are. So it's, O Lord, open thou my lips. And then response is, and my mouth shall show forth thy praise. The caller says, make haste, O God, to deliver me. Make haste, O God, to deliver me. And the response is, make haste to help me, O Lord. And then everyone says in unison what's known as the Gloria Patri. Those are Latin phrases for the glory to the Father. And the phrase which everybody says together is, glory be to the Father and to the Son and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. And then there's an invitatory, which changes regularly. In this case, the invitatory, let me see if I have it for you. I'm going to have to just find it. This case, the invitatory is, O come, let us worship the Lord. And then the response is, for he is our maker. And then everyone says in unison what's known as the Venite, which comes from the first two words in Latin of this particular song, the Venite, which is usually chanted. We're going to speak it. The Venite comes from the Psalms. And we say together, O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth, and the heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, for his hands formed the dry land. O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. And then we repeat the Gloria Patri, Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. And then the invitatory, which is the first part of this, is repeated. And the invitatory is, O come, let us worship the Lord. And the response is, for he is our maker. Now, I'm just going to stop there. The service goes on, but you can tell how this is an affirmation. It isn't pleading and begging and all kinds of gobbledygook. It's an affirmation. It's a way of starting the day. It's a way for people to gather around either individually. You can do this yourself, as I'm doing it now. You can, and I do it every day by myself, as a matter of fact. You can do it as a group, a husband and wife group. You can do it as a family. You can do it as a church. And there's an affirmation. It says, oh, Lord, open thou my lips. Lord, I want to praise you. I want to praise you, the first line. And it says, and my mouth shall show forth your praise. So we begin the day with praise. It's a positive thing. Christianity emphasizes praise, and Christianity emphasizes thanksgiving, and Christianity emphasizes happiness. Christianity is a very happy religion. We're very happy with God and very happy with what God has done for us. And so, O Lord, open thou my lips, and my mouth shall show forth your praise. And the next response, make haste, O God, to deliver me. And then the answer is, make haste to help me, O Lord. If there is anything from which I need to be saved, if there is anything that I need to be protected from, if there's any accident out there, if I'm going to fall and trip and break my finger, whatever it's going to be, or if there are enemies out there plotting, and you know, this is all true, whatever untoward thing is out there that might hurt me, I say as a prayer, make haste, O God, to deliver me. Make haste to help me, O Lord. That's a hope-filled statement. Not a begging, groveling, obsequious statement. It's a hope-filled statement. I praise you, O God, because you've been good to me, and I ask you, God, to continue to be good to me and to protect me from all that would harm me. And then you say, you give the praise, glory, glory to the Father, and glory to the Son, and glory to the Holy Spirit. Remember that Christianity is a Trinitarian religion. One God, three persons, one God. It's one of the mysteries of faith. We don't bother to try to explain it. We accept it as what has been revealed to us, that God is a unity in Trinity and a Trinity in unity. Sounds like gobbledygook, but that is our faith, and it's beyond comprehension. It's no more gobbledygook, by the way, than eternity. I like to say this to people about they get all wrapped around the Trinity concept, and they say, well, how can you Christians buy into that? And I say, well, do you believe in eternal? And they say, well, what do you mean? What do you mean? I say, well, you do believe in forever. And they say, oh, we understand. We say, well, you know, the lazy eight on his side, you know, that's the infinity. Do you believe in infinity? They say, well, yeah, that's a scientific principle. Infinity is a scientific principle. And I say, do you believe it? Oh, it's true. It's true. It's no doubt about it. We use it in mathematical equations. I said, well, what about the Trinity? Oh, no, no, that's gobbledygook, gobbledygook. Well, it's one God in three persons and three persons in one God, unity in Trinity and Trinity in unity. We can't believe that. That's gobbledygook. But I say to them, but you believe in eternity. You believe in forever. You believe in infinity. Well, yeah, that's a mathematical formula. Of course we believe scientific. So I say to them, okay, let's say that we get in a spaceship, you and I, and it travels at the speed of light. Can you imagine that? And let's just imagine that we can go forward in this spaceship for 100 years. So we're traveling at the speed of light for 100 years. And when we get at the end of 100 years, at the minute of the clock strikes the end of 100 years, we stop. Have we reached infinity? Have we reached eternity? Have we reached forever? And they look at me like I'm some kind of a jackass. Well, hey, no, I'm asking a question. This is, you just told me that it's true, it's scientifically true, it's a provable fact, it's a mathematical formula in the equation, with no doubt about it. Well, I said, okay, now we've traveled the speed of light in a spaceship, you and I, for 100 years, we come to a stop, and now we've reached infinity. Well, the answer is no, we have not reached infinity, because you see, infinity can never be reached. You can never come to the end of infinity. You can never come to the end of eternal. You can never come to the end of forever, because it's no longer infinity if you come to the end of it. It's no longer eternal if you come to the end of it. And it's no longer any of those things if you come to the end of it. You see, infinity is a concept. And the word is a word, a symbol, infinity. So many letters put together. Don't ask me to spell. I'm not going to do a Dan Quayle here. But infinity is a word, a symbol, a series of symbols, letters, describing a concept, a mental concept, which we believe to be accurate scientifically, in other words, experientially. It's something that can be experienced with some form of a regularity. The word infinity can. But you can never get to it. You can never hold it in your hand. You can never pin it down. You can never show it to me in a museum box. You can never display it for me because, first of all, in my human sense, I'm not infinity. I'm not eternal. I'm not forever. So I can never reach that in my human sense, in the body. You see what I'm saying? You see, so people who want to knock all over us about, you gobble the good Christians with Trinity, unity and Trinity, Trinity and unity. You're just gobbledygook. That's just religious gobbledygook. You can be accused of the same when you talk about infinity and forever. And the funny part about it is Christians who are the founders of Western science and Christians who are the promoters of Western science and Christians who are the founders of Western scientific method, Mendel, Gregor Mendel, the father of modern DNA research and modern father of modern biology, and Newton, the father of modern physics, all Christians, you see. Galileo, modern astronomy, Christian. No, don't worry about whether the church liked him or not. That's not the point. Galileo was a Christian. And so on and so on and so forth. And many, many today are Christians who are in the scientific community. But we need to get into our school system a respect for conceptualization, a respect for where these things came from. If we don't know where we came from, we will never be able to get to where we're going. We're going to, when we lose our past, we lose our present. And when we lose our present, we lose our compass. And when we lose our compass, we lose our way, we get lost. And my greatest fear, by the way, I'm just going to have one negative on it. It's not a negative, it's an anxiety for the present society. It's that we're losing our way because we're forgetting our past. And we're losing our way and we're going to lose our present. And when we lose our present and don't longer have the compass of the past, which is based because we're Western civilization. And I'll just make a comment about that. Everybody wants to say, we have to teach about Eastern civilization. Yeah, fine, at college. And we have to teach about Islam and Hinduism and all that kind of. Yeah, you can teach that they exist, but don't promote them. I know a lot of people are promoting. Let me use an example of what I'm talking about. Recently, I came across a fact that startles me. I am absolutely, I don't even know what to say. In the local school systems in New Jersey, and I understand I have my family is also in Georgia, and my family is also in Massachusetts. I understand that the public school system has officially abandoned the teaching of script writing. You know, longhand, that the public school systems, check it out in your own community, the public school systems have officially abandoned the teaching of cursive writing, which is, longhand, script writing. It has been. We don't have to teach it anymore. Our children are taught to print only. They're not taught to sign their signature. They're not taught to connect an E to an F to a G to an H in longhand. They do not, and they are not being taught cursive writing. And the reason is because the educators are telling us, the teachers so-called, are telling us, the population, that we don't need that anymore. People have computers. It's all in print. They have internet. It's all in print. They have books, which are printed. And so the need for longhand or script or cursive writing is no longer valuable, and therefore we can abandon that safely, and our children will be none the lesser. I beg to differ. I think it's very important to keep cursive writing, keep longhand writing. Recently, I have a pen pal system with my grandchildren, and I write them notes and cards and letters, and you know that I have to print it. Even to my 9-year-old and to my 12-year-old grandchildren, I have to print it in block letters, or they cannot read what I write to them. They cannot communicate with me by cursive writing, by longhand. Now, this is being officially promoted in the schools as a good thing. They can use that time better teaching the children about transvestitism or cross-dressing. And believe me, I know that's the truth because my grandchildren are bringing me home all kinds of stories about being a transvestite or transgender person. And listen, I'm not into that value thing on this program, but don't tell me that you would rather do that than teach my grandchildren cursive writing, longhand, script writing. They need to learn how to do that. Now, I remember back, we started learning longhand in first grade. And it was, what did we learn? 1 hour a day? 1 hour? Even a half hour a day? We were sent home with these booklets. You know, they had the three lines. The middle line was a dotted line. And we were taught how to make longhand E's and F's and G's and so on and so forth. And then we were taught how to connect them together into a word like school or grandpa or whatever. It's really not a big difficult thing. And I think that by the fourth grade, at the very latest, I knew how to longhand write and write in cursive script. And by the fifth and sixth grade, I had a down pat. There was no longer any need to have penmanship lessons. So what are we saying here? We're saying that the public school systems in the states of New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Georgia, and I'm sure that's true in other states, have decided that, you know, spending a half an hour or maybe an hour a day on penmanship, teaching the children how to write longhand in script and cursive writing, is not valuable, not worth it. They would rather teach transvestitism and cross-dressing. Now, please, I'm insulted by that, and I think it's a terrible, terrible thing, and it's a shame on the teachers, shame on the administrators, and shame, oh, well, we have to teach them things that are much more doable today. Listen, by the sixth grade, you have to stop teaching it because you don't teach longhand anymore. So I would say to them, reevaluate that. And if you're listening to this and you find out in your school system that your school system has stopped teaching cursive writing, you have two choices. Now, the teachers in my area, and I've made quite a bit of objection to that, and the administrators have told me, well, if you feel so strongly about it, teach it to them yourself. Those books for longhand and cursive and script writing, all the same thing, actually, are available. The penmanship books are available. The pens and pencils are available. The cards, the flashcards that teach how to write longhand are available. If you're so hot to trot on cursive writing, then, sir, you go teach your grandchildren yourself. Well, you know, we're paying these public school teachers to teach our children, and we're not teaching them religion. We're not asking you, even though my grandchildren are bringing home all kinds of religion from their public school teachers, and it's not a religion that I agree with. And separation of church and state is also the teaching of secularism. So we don't teach Judaism. We don't teach Hinduism. We don't teach Islam, or it's not, there's no such word as Islamism, but just to be consistent here, and Christianityism, we don't teach that, but we teach all kinds of other secular isms, to pick on it. You know, I'm not crazy about the sex topics, but I don't really care about those topics. I think those topics are completely unimportant, but I think cursive writing and penmanship and being able to express yourself in cursive writing is important. So that's one man's opinion on that. And why do I bring it up on this program? Well, because it's another attempt by the public system to divorce us. Excuse me. It's another attempt by the public system to divorce, to separate us, to break us away from our culture. Now, I said culture, not religion. Well, because, see, in the first part of this program, I explained to you my opinion that Christianity is bigger than just dogma, just teaching, just doctrine, just theology. It's the founder of Western civilization because it perpetuated Greek, and Roman culture and teaching and the like. Geometry, trigonometry, you know, all that good stuff. English, Latin, languages, reading, writing, arithmetic, healthcare, the founding of universities, hospitals, all that kind of ethics, morals, jurisprudence, legalities, the whole code of law based upon the great teachers, the jurists, the lawyers and the doctors of the church during the first from the first century up until at least the 12th and 13th century, when they were the primary, when the church lawyers were the primary carriers of jurisprudence in Western civilization. We're divorcing ourselves from that in all kinds of ways, not the least of which is this ridiculous statement about separation of church and state, which is just a cover-up for some kind of stupidity. It's not a conspiracy, it's just stupidity, and it's narrow-mindedness, small-mindedness, short-sightedness on the part of so-called educators who think that the best thing to do is to divorce us from our culture. And our culture is intimately tied up with, it's almost one being with Christianity. And you don't understand the culture if you don't understand Christianity. You don't understand the art, the literature, the music. You don't understand any of that unless you you put it in the context of Christianity and the Christian church. And the Christian church, that's where I want to focus on that. And the Christian church. Now, we're going to talk in a few minutes more about the Christian church as being that which helps us to be whole. Now, the topic we're talking about is whole person, a complete 100% person, a whole family, a whole complete 100% family, a whole community, you see. And I'm suggesting to you, and I think you can see where I'm going with this, is that you have to include, you have to embrace, you have to incorporate Western civilization's past. Now, people out there, I'm sure, say, oh, you mean the Crusades? Listen, the Crusades were a very small part of it. And the Crusades have social and economic, political, and geopolitical reasons. There's economic, there's famine, there's hunger, there's sociological factors, there's economic factors, there's political factors. All of these coalesce into the making of the Crusades. Christianity is the vehicle for that. Maybe it's, in some respects, it may even be the philosophical, theological context or excuse for it, but maybe even somewhat the motivator. I mean, I'm not going to discount any of those claims. However, to misunderstand the Crusades as the Christian church never had that much power. The Christian church never had that much power. That's just ridiculous to say that. We never had the power to raise armies like that. It was the kings. I don't want to go into that. It was a whole course. I could teach another course at the college level. I'm told, you know, if you have a doctorate degree, you should be doing these things. Well, maybe I should be. But anyhow, I'll do it on these programs a little bit at a time. Okay, we're going to go into the church in a minute. We'll talk about the church, and there's a reason I would like you to stay with us, because I would like to tie everything we've spoken of together, tie it up into a little bit more maybe cohesive and coherent approach. My one son, my youngest son, says to me all the time, he said, Dad, you know, you like to, the way you think is that you enter a hallway and you go into every room and you examine everything in every room. And when you leave the room, you leave the door open. And then you go into the next room and the next room. When you get to the end of the hallway, you look back down the hallway and you try to put it all together that you've seen everything that's in every room and you've examined everything in every room and you left all the doors open. And when you leave the hallway, he said to me, even then you don't close the door. You leave the door open because you don't like to close things. Well, he's right. I don't like to close things. To close things is to close learning. To close doors, even with the closing of a book sometimes, you know, you close it. Well, I don't like that. I'm just going to tell you, I'm not that kind of a person. I'm open-minded. And I think open-mindedness, and what I would like to share with you on that, is to be always ready to learn, always ready to expand, always ready to appreciate. And in the context, when we get to talk about the Christian church, we're going to talk about a little bit about the Reformation and some context for the Reformation as well, that maybe will startle some of you, because I am a Lutheran, and I have not always felt this way, but as I've gotten a little bit older, I've begun, and I'll tell you about it in a little bit, a little bit critical, maybe even very critical, of Protestantism, including Lutheranism, Methodism, Episcopalianism, Presbyterianism, all that kind of stuff. Stay with me. I'd like to take a pause here because I think we all need a break. I have another song. We just did Jacob's Ladder, which is a great song. And maybe we can go into, let me see if I have one here. Yeah, these are the songs you hear every week. But there's a great song with All I Am. It's a great song. I love it. Let's do that. It's a little bit longer song. There's a girl singer here. I download all of this music from dmusic.com. dmusic.com. I realize I'm talking pretty quickly here. I have to slow down, you know. Rush Limbaugh and Sean, the big talk show host. None of them, even the late night show guy, what's his name? Anyway, doesn't talk this fast. But so forgive me if I'm speaking to, I'll try to speak slower. Okay, let's see here. With All I Am is the name of the song, downloaded from dmusic.com. I think it's still up there. I'll have to look on the internet after this is done to figure out if dmusic.com still exists. But that's where I got it from, public domain music. With All I Am is the name of the song. I wish I knew the name of the singer, but I've been unable to retrieve that in repeatedly going back to dmusic.com. Listen in and stay with us.
Palm of your hand.
Hello, this is Pastor Fred. I'm back, and isn't that a beautiful song? I cannot tell you how much I love that song. I really wish, if you can find out who did that, maybe if she's still around and like this, hasn't been doing anything and she still wants to sing, maybe she can produce some more of those beautiful songs for the faith. It's beautiful. There are a lot of Christian stuff on that dmusic.com from the past, not too much in the present, sadly enough. It doesn't seem to be, economically viable. Interestingly enough, that's an interesting topic, isn't it? Why is Christian art, Christian culture, Christian society, Christian music, everything, not so much Christian music, I think, it's pretty much the same, but only when it's economically viable. That sort of reinforces what I was talking about earlier in the program, is that, centuries ago, we were dependent upon, or we had a more intimate interaction with the church. And so things like building churches were economically viable. We, even as late as the 1950s, building churches was a big thing, and you could make a lot of money building churches. So architects did design churches. I happen to have a church that's octagonal, and it's almost a circle. It's quite a unique building. But those are the high days, 1966, 67, 68, when the building of churches across America was going at high speed. And so many architectural firms dedicated themselves to the creation of new architectural forms, and beautiful new architectural forms using the latest arches. Has these magnificent laminated arches. It's a wood interior. It's a magnificent building. And inside of that building, the artist just died, Hendrik Vandenberg, wonderful, wonderful artist, who created all of our stained glass windows in the church that we occupy now. And he also, it was viable. He loved doing a stained glass. The only people who were doing stained glass was the church, and he was paid a good life. He had a good life. He made some good money. And he eventually joined up with Lam Studios, one of the biggest studios. These are all free plugs. Lam Studios, one of the biggest of the stained glass window people out here on the East Coast. And he created some of the most magnificent. Our windows are, I think they're about 10 feet or 12 feet wide and about 6 feet high. And they're magnificent, and they're unique and different. All of the Hendrik Vandenberg windows are pieces of art. As a matter of fact, we have one piece of the Hendrik art, our window, window that's depicting the Good Samaritan story, which faces off into the street onto Washington Avenue in Bergenfield, is signed. We have a pane of glass that was broken, and there was a car accident, and a few of those, not many, just a few panes were broken, and Mr. Hendrik Vandenberg was in the area, and I asked him to make a new pieces of glass. He had exactly the right colors. He had exactly the right way of making the glass. He was the maker of the glass himself, like Tiffany was the maker of the glass, and so he made them for us. He fabricated them. And then I asked him if he would be so kind as to sign one of the panes. And so I actually have a signature of Hendrik Vandenberg in the front window. I, as far as I know, it's one of the only signed stained glass windows in America. We know from others that they did them, like Comfort Tiffany did them and so on, but we don't have a signature. We have his signature markings, like in the Comfort Tiffany windows, you have the head, the hands, and the feet were done by Mr. Tiffany himself. The rest was done by artists within the studio. That's how we know it's an original Tiffany, but in this case, Hendrik actually signed it. I'm very proud of that, and I don't know. It may be out there. If you know anything about stained glass, you can tell me. Send me an email. Let me know whether we are the only stained glass window signed by the artist, or whether other artists signed them. I mean, actual script signature, not a port within the window. I understand that the middle-aged guys put themselves in the portraits of their paintings and put themselves on the ceilings of their churches and put themselves in the other ways, but I mean an actual signature of an artist, at least in the modern time. Now, see, all of these things were viable in those days, the 1960s, and people could make a living, and therefore Christian art, Christian sculpture, Christian painting, Christian architecture flourished in the United States because it was all that great building and people were tied to it economically. And that's the same thing as I was talking about in the previous section of the program, when after the empire fell, of course, the church did have resources. It did have the ability to barter, and most of it was a bartering system. It wasn't a gold and silver or money system. Barter was the name of the game. But, it, you know, we could barter food and clothing and shelter and protection for goods and services, including artwork. And so the local silversmiths and the local people did work with the churches in return for initially a barter system. And then eventually, as the coinage system was restored under the different warlords or counts or dukes or whatever you want to call them, and then with the rising up of nation states under Charlemagne and so on, 800, 900 AD and that type of thing, you know, the coinage is all returning. Then the money system returns, and the artisans can get paid in money for the architecture and so on. But, you know, in the Great Stone Cathedral, masons could be paid, and the great stained glass windows makers at Chartres could be paid, and on and on and on. You understand the idea. Today, we do not have very much monetary reason for doing Christian art, and there is some in Christian music. We do have a thriving Christian music area in terms of sheet music for choirs, but that's under great stress. And then we have the Christian artists, the rock bands, the folk music, the Christian contemporary scene today with the Christian music, which is mostly connected to big rallies and concerts and the sale of CDs. Not all that tremendously connected to the Universal Christian Church per se. It is somewhat more of a business. And there is the Christian literature, which is produced, again, aimed at Christians, seeking to inform and entertain and delight Christians, but connected per se to the Christian Church, I would say not. It's really sort of a separate thing altogether, which leads me to the topic I want to just deal with a little bit before we move on. And that is the idea that Protestantism in the Reformation did what it was accused of doing. The one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church had already been severed into two pieces in 1054 when the eastern part of the church, for various and sundry reasons, separated its allegiance to Rome in the Great Schism. And it's schism, not schism. But I guess you could say schism. I mean, what difference does it make? I used to say schism most of my life anyway until somebody corrected me and I found out that it is actually schism, and S-C-H-I-S-M, schism. But I guess you could say schism, you say Schoenfeld. So, anyway, going back to that, the next big breaking up of the church happens in the 1400s and early 1500s under Martin Luther and John Calvin and John Knox and Cranmer and Zwingli and all these characters who carry out the Reformation. And it's, I don't want to go into that. That's another year-long course at the college level at least. But just to say that all of these reformers who found that the church was corrupted, and they were right, wanted to reform or refresh or renew or help the Christian church, and they were being accused, and they were accused accurately of tearing the Christian church apart. And that ties in, by the way, with my last program, about me and my Bible, or me and my Jesus, or me and my religion. You know, we used to have a quip at seminary. It's Johnny and Billy, Mary and Jane, us four, and no more. And Protestantism, I think, can be accused of that. And I think modern Protestantism, even more so than any other time, can be accused of that. You know, Mary, Jane, Bobby, and Billy, us four, and no more. The localization or the individualization or what should we call it, the privatization, I don't know what you're going to call that. The disintegration, maybe that's the word, disintegration. The disintegration. The Christian church is an integrated unity, you know. The people gather together in a common union called the congregation. with the gathering congregation, aggregate, congregate, same things. The congregation is joined together in the diocese, which is the group within which all the congregations exist, are overseen by a bishop. The different dioceses or groups of 10 or 20 or 30 congregations which produce a diocese produce an archdiocese, that which is an arch over, it goes over from left to right or right to left or up or down, whatever you want to call it. It arches over, so the archdiocese is made up of many dioceses overseen or administered by an archbishop. Then all the archbishops together form the church under the pope or the patriarch. And in the Orthodox Church of the East, it's the same. Basically, the congregations form into the diocese overseen by a bishop. The bishop is joins together the diocese under the archbishop or the metropolitan, and the metropolitans join together under the patriarch. And that's the fundamental structural unity of the church. But in Protestantism, it's, Mary, Jane, Billy, and John, us four, and no more. That's the little church on the corner, unrelated to and not caring about its neighbor church across the street or down the block, because, we have the truth and they don't, or we have the right way and they don't, or we sing the right songs and they don't, and we pray the right prayers and they don't, we're the Calvinists, or we're the Lutherans, or we're the Methodists, or we're the Presbyterians. By the way, before we go on with that, I want to make a little comment here about that. Lutheranism really doesn't exist. It really shouldn't. I'm a Lutheran, but I do say that. I am a Lutheran. That's ridiculous, actually. I'm a Christian whose church is named the Lutheran Church. Our doctrinal position is we are no different than the Roman Catholics in the essentials of faith. Now, there are a few little issues here and there about Mary, which are relatively minor. And I think if you understood it in the broader sense, at least this Lutheran doesn't see an issue. There's some issues of authority, whether the Pope has this authority or that authority. But we believe in Jesus Christ, the Lord and Savior of the world, and we have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Lutheranism is a method of organization. It's a method of organization. Oh, I know people will argue me about that, but I'm telling you right now, it's a method of organization. Presbyterianism, Episcopalianism, Methodism, Pentecostalism. Pentecostalism is a little different, but it's a method of organization. And it's also a pattern of worship. The Methodist worship is very different than Pentecostal worship, but both of them, whether it's the guy out in the tent in the Sawdust Trail, he has liturgy, whether he wants to call it that or not. He has a liturgy. He has a way in which he does business from A to B or C, and he has a methodology of operation, and he has a form of governance or government, and he has requirements for membership or non-membership, and he follows a particular pattern of belief or unbelief. And so the most fundamentalist, quote-unquote, and I don't even like that word, but the most down in the Sawdust Trail, out in a tent in the woods kind of guy is just as organized and structured and doctrinal and dogmatic as the highest church Lutheran or the most pontifical of the Catholics, or the most patriarchal of the Orthodox. So to say that you don't have those things, or to rail against the other guy's way of doing it, is just false. It's not true. It's closed-minded and small. And it doesn't help the church. It doesn't help the church. It doesn't help us to present the church to the society as the place where we can be made whole. Now, I used the word disintegration a minute ago. I think that's one of the things that we have to deal with in terms of the person. I think we as Western civilization people, European people, or those affected by European culture, which includes South Americans and Hispanics and Africans and all these others, we are seeing a disintegration. And the disintegration is brought about by the idea that we don't need to pay any attention to our heritage, which is the Christian, European, Roman, Greco, Jewish culture. Now, as a smaller contributors to that, you have Persian culture and you have Arabic culture contributing, and you have even Oriental cultures contributing. But fundamentally, we are, if we come from the European stock line, you know, genetics, we are fundamentally Christian, Roman, Greek, Jews, a little bit Arabs, and a little bit Persians in our culture. And when we deny that and we try to say that we're not that, we'll lose our place. We lose our bearings. First of all, we're lying to ourselves. Christianity has nothing to do with today. No, it has everything to do with today. Christianity has nothing to do with culture or music or education or the university or the hospital or the ethics of the culture or the jurisprudence of our time. Baloney. That's just bad. That's bad academics. It's bad scholarship. Bashing it. Christianity must be bashed in terms of jurisprudence. Christianity must be smashed in terms of music. Christianity must be destroyed in terms of art. Christianity must be repudiated in terms of education. Christianity must be mocked in terms of morality. No, that's just bad academics. That's just bad. It's stupid. Those people who believe that, and those people who practice it, and I'm afraid to tell you, that's the majority of the educational institutions, from the highest to the lowest, in my opinion, they're wrong. They're bad educators. The educational system is wrong. And the most egregious are the college-level people who most certainly should know better. I mean, I can excuse a fourth-grade teacher because the fourth-grade teacher is teaching, hopefully, reading and printing. I used to be reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's now reading, printing, and arithmetic. But I'm sad about that. I think cursive writing has a place. We've mentioned that before. But the upper-level people who make their life and their career out of bashing, smashing, destroying, and causing a massive disintegration of Western culture in favor of what? In favor of chaos. In favor of disintegration. Now, because of this academic, and I put it right squarely on the college communities, whether it's Harvard, Yale, or anybody, all of them, this promotion, which has been going on, I would suggest, for the last 70 years, since maybe even the time of Woodrow Wilson, maybe even the last 90 years, Princeton, former Princeton president and then president of the United States, who, as Glenn Beck rightly said, told people that the purpose of education, higher education, was to divorce a person as far away from their parents' values as it is possible to divorce them, is it possible to get them, tear them out of the culture and the values and the mindset and the welcome challenge, the worldview of their parents. Why? Why are we rejecting that which Woodrow Wilson says is because we, the educators, want to remold, remake, and reform and restructure the minds of these children who don't even belong to us. They're loaned to us, they're given to us, they're entrusted to us for the purposes of educating them, bringing them to a higher level of intelligence and not. An entire level of intelligence, folks, is not by bashing my grandmother's value system. It's not by smashing my grandfather's religion. It's not by tearing apart my mother's culture. It's not by repudiating all that my ancestors have stood for all these many years. How can I explain that a little bit? I won't go into that. It'll take too long. Okay, having said all that, what is the answer? I think the answer is, for those of us who are concerned about that, and I am, that's why I have this program today, to assert that wholeness, completeness, can be found in the Christian church. Now, I'm not saying Roman Catholicism per se or Orthodoxy per se or anything. Personally, I think there should be no Orthodoxy. I don't think there should be any Roman Catholicism or any Protestantism or any Pentecostalism or Methodism or Lutheranism or Episcopalianism or whatever isms. I think we are one holy Christian apostolic church founded upon the beliefs of the church from the earliest times as enunciated in the Nicene, the apostles, and the Athanasian creeds, the three great creeds of the church, and as enunciated for us in the great councils of the church, the Constantinople Council, the Nicaea Council, the Ephesus Councils, and the rest. And each council correcting the other council, because when we get it wrong, we get together again, and we get it wrong again. And we keep getting it wrong for the last, I say that facetiously. I think we've gotten it right every time, but we've gotten it right within the context of the history of the time and our understanding of that which went on before us, that which is going on now in the present, and that which we project, and we're not prophets nor the son of prophets, will happen in the future. And we make judgments, the great councils of the church make judgments as to what they believe under the guidance of the Holy Spirit is the best thing for the time in, that they're asked to address these issues. So I'm very much a conciliar Christian. And I think we do need to return to that idea of one holy Catholic / Christian, Catholic and Christian. Catholic means universal. So one holy universal. If we let's translate the word, because we translate una into one. We translate sancta into holy. We use the word Catholic and we don't translate it. So let's translate it properly. One. I believe that there should be, and there is, and there should only be one holy, universal Christian church based upon the Holy Trinity. Now, when we reaffirm that among ourselves as Christians, I think we need also to reaffirm the bigness and broadness of Christianity's inclusivity. And Christianity is a very inclusive religion. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have a belief system. It doesn't mean that we don't think this is true and that is true and this is wrong and that is wrong. However, we are inclusive. And if you want to look at one of the most inclusive forms of Christianity, you only have to look at Roman Catholicism. A Franciscan is not a Dominican. A Dominican is not a Capuchin. A Capuchin is not a vocationist. A vocationist is not a member of any other order. Franciscan, none of these people, they're all separated. A Jesuit is not an Augustinian. Augustinian is not a Benedictine. All of these forms, which are monastic forms, by the way, represent different Marianist is is another form. Let's put it that way. I can't find a comparison for a Marianist. But all of these are forms of the one holy, universal Christian church. And they're valid in every way because all of these forms adhere to the core, which is the Apostles, the Nicene, and the Athanasian Creeds, and the explications and explanations and the teachings of the various councils of the church and also as explained to them and as enunciated for each and every time by the magisterium. The magisterium being the patriarchs, the metropolitans, and the bishops in the East and in the West, the Pope, the Archbishop, and the bishops, and even in Protestantism, the Archbishops and the bishops, and the church councils, although we don't have councils in the church, we have conventions, which are not at any way to be. I would never put a Lutheran church convention, even a convention of the Lutheran World Federation, I would never put that on the same par with the great council of Constantinople or the great council of Nicaea or the great council of Ephesus, the many Ephesian councils, or any of those. Or the Vatican I or Vatican II, a Lutheran convention, even of the Lutheran World Federation, doesn't even come close theologically to that credibility. It's merely a convention, a meeting of people, much lower than a church council. Nobody would elevate any Lutheran convention of any form to the ability to formulate the enunciation of Christian understanding of doctrine. It just doesn't happen. And anybody who does that, I think they're just fools. And that's my opinion. My opinion. Okay. Now, when we've reasserted the wholeness of the church, I think we need to encourage our educators to look at Western. If you're, you know, I'm not talking about Chinese people. This is a different ballpark, or Indian from India, or Sumatrans from Sumatra. I'm not even talking about those people. And most certainly I'm not talking about people in Swaziland, although I could be. And Swaziland and Rwanda, there's a whole different thing about Africa, which I love Africa. I have a great affection for Africa, and I have a heartbreak for Africa. And I think we're going to enter into the African century very soon. I think Africa, sub-Sahara Africa, is probably in the ascendancy as going to become one of the great cultural resources for the next, maybe the next millennium, maybe even the next millennium. It depends. It depends on how that all works out. But I believe that it's possible that that could happen. But sticking with North Africa and with Europe, the Mediterranean basin, those of us who come out of that culture, I believe in order to have wholeness, we have to understand our Greco roots, our Greek roots, we have to understand our Roman roots, and then we have to, if we're Christians, we have to understand, as we've talked out throughout this entire program, our Christian roots, which is an inclusive, a holistic approach to government, to society, and the like. Just to use one example, you know, I'm amazed. Let's take a place like Harvard. You know, Harvard is a great school, a big school, and it's founded by Christians and members of the Christian church, the Congregationalists, I think it is. And please correct me if I'm wrong. You can do that through an email. And they founded it as a seminary and a university. And the fundamental thing was to teach Christians how to be educated, you know, educate Christians and educate people from a Christian perspective. And then, you know, what happens is that Harvard goes off in the last 150 years and becomes fundamentally a secular university with a seminary attached. The same thing happens at Yale University and many other of the great universities. Sadly enough, the ascendancy of secularism and the ascendancy of secular teachers and the ascendancy of the PhD as the only fundamental basis for teaching, and the prejudice of secularism, I would even say communism and socialism, over the last 150 years, has divorced the university from its roots. And so I personally, I would just put Harvard in there with the local community college. I really would. I don't see any difference. I don't see any difference. And Notre Dame and Georgetown University, which have now, it seems to me, turned upon their Catholicism and are antagonistic to their Catholicism and are actually like a fifth column against their Catholicism, they're no better than the local community college either. You know, Notre Dame education, a Georgetown education, a Yale education, a Harvard Uni education. Folks, if you're going to send your kids to college, send them down the block to a local community college. You'll have much more control over the teaching there. You'll have much more control of your children, and they won't be going out and having beer binges every night in the dormitories and you know, and dying on the basketball courts and the football fields, because that's what it's all about. And education is not what it's about. Chapel is not what it's about. Christianity is not what it's about. Your faith and my faith and your values and my values and your culture and my culture are not what it's about. We send our children away to college at our peril and at the peril of our children. I would no longer say to people that you can safely send your children away to college. I think that it's a dangerous endeavor to do so, not only physically, where they're in danger of not drugs so much, but alcoholism and sexual transmitted diseases and all of that good stuff, but they're also being destroyed in their soul and in their spirit by a totally secularist and anti-Christian faculty, just, I think, across the board. That's one man's opinion. Yes, I have a doctorate. I know that. I know that. Okay. And yes, I went to school to get the doctorate, but I went to Christian schools. And I made sure I went to Christian schools. And if I didn't have a Christian teacher, I let him know that he wasn't a Christian, and I went and had a different professor instead. Oh, well, what's the matter with you? Don't you want to listen to the other side of the coin? No, I don't. No, I don't want to listen to the other side of the coin. The other side of the coin, if he wants to teach that, let him go to a place that stands for that. Don't be a fifth column person in a seminary and attack the divinity of Jesus. Don't be a professor at a seminary and attack the validity of the Bible. Don't be a professor in Harvard or Yale founded by Christians and be on the attack against the holy universal Christian church and bashing it and smashing it at every turn. Don't call yourself a professor of religion at other great Christian schools and be constantly trying to debunk the reality of Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. Have some. These professors all tell me they have integrity. They tell me they are people of great stature and the like more, when all they are is people who are taking the money and taking the position and taking the social status, and what they are is debunkers and destroyers. How about making a contribution, folks? You know, Christianity makes contributions. We help society. We've always have, and we always will do that. Okay, enough of that. I'm lambasting. I'm getting off the topic. it's prejudice. I know it. I know it. Okay. Yeah, that's my prejudice. It is my prejudice. That's how I feel. That's my prejudgment based upon my own experience. Now, what are we going to say about that? When you know where you came from, I think you have a good chance of understanding where you are. Now, when we learn about our history and we learn about our religion and we learn about our culture, we learn it properly without prejudice. We learn the facts, just the facts, please. Like they used to say on Dragnet. Friday used to say, I'll show my age here. Friday used to say, "The facts, man, just the facts, nothing but the facts." You know, I think that's something along those lines. Those of you who are my age can remember that program, Dragnet. When we teach the facts, just teach them. So this guy did this, this guy did that, this guy did this, this guy did that. You know, and we teach our students how to discern facts. I let me just tell you a true story. I had a professor in a graduate school in preparation for my doctorate. This is an interesting story. I know I'm going off again. Forgive me, but this is just a conversation. I hope you don't mind. I hope I'm not abusing you. I don't want to. I want to make this a friendly conversation. I was in seminary doing my doctoral work, and I had a professor, he can remain nameless, who wanted me to study genetics for his course. It was a course on genetics. And I decided that I wanted to talk about the idea of artificial insemination and in vitro fertilization and the like more. And I researched that. I spent the whole 13 weeks researching that. I wrote a 90 page paper. The requirement was for a 25 page paper. I wrote a 90 page paper because I found the topic so interesting and so difficult to handle. And I had about I'm just using this as shorthand so you understand the context. It was 90 pages of script, and I guess I had about 15 pages of footnotes. And my bibliography included over 100 books that I referenced. And I wrote the paper, and the professor on page one, in the first paragraph, wrote a big, long answer to my statement. And then on the second and third and fourth, all the way through it, he had long paragraphs. He didn't just call attention to this fact or that fact. He had long paragraphs, and every one of his paragraphs was antagonistic to what I had to say in the paper. He was taking uppance at everything that I put forward, whether it was a scientific study, whether it was a sociological study that I quoted, or a cultural study that I studied, or a research paper that I used, or some biological experiment that I used, or some references to the great geneticists of our time and their papers and what they wrote. He just took every single page. He wrote at least for every single page. The professor, for 90 pages, wrote a paragraph in response to everything that I had to say. At the end of the paper, he gave me a low grade. And then, because it was graded, and I'm always surprised that anything at the doctoral level is graded. I disagree with anything that's graded at the doctoral level. I don't believe in grades at that level. That's just absurd. But anyway, he gave me a very low grade, and he wrote this comment. He said, you know, I told you in class this fact and that fact, and you did not deal with those facts in your paper. I told you in my class, he writes in the paper, about this guy and that guy, and you do not even have those guys in your bibliography. And so I can see that you're just narrow-minded in your viewpoint. And so he wrote at the end, of his last comment was, a very well-researched paper and a very well-argued paper and an excellent presentation of your prejudiced position. And then he gave me a very low grade. Now, I was absolutely startled. College and grad school are not about agreeing with the professor. College and grad school are not about regurgitating what the professor told you. Now, that he said I didn't deal with those people, they didn't fit within the parameters of what I wanted to talk about. Just like no book can be all-inclusive, I wasn't writing an encyclopedia. As it was, the 90 pages that I wrote were down. I had my original draft was 130 pages. That's a doctoral thesis, for goodness sakes. That's how much interest I had in the topic. I brought that topic down from 130 pages to 90 pages, and of course I had to leave whole sections out, and some of the stuff that I left out were, you know, I didn't find his people at all up to snuff. As a matter of fact, I found his comments, the people he wanted me to study, and the people he wanted me to read about, antithetical to any kind of scientific approach. I found his writers to be unworthy of inclusion in the paper. And I told him that. And he was incensed. He was furious at me. Of course, I guess I was calling him an idiot, I guess. And I think he was. And not because he gave me a low grade, because I didn't care. I wrote the paper. I'm proud of the paper. I just read it recently. And it was an excellent paper. There were a few little pieces maybe here and there. I said I'm an open-minded people with an open-door policy, an open door to my mind. And I do read papers that I wrote 5 years ago and 10 years ago, and I read them again and say, oh, well, in the context of what I know today, I would have added this or subtracted that or put this in or taken this out, and maybe I wouldn't have been so strident here, and maybe I would have been a little bit more strident there. But you see, the guy's whole idea was that he was teaching graduate students at the doctoral level to parrot his opinions. I don't want to parrot his opinions. Or even, I didn't even care to take his opinions into account. I didn't care what his opinions were. Maybe that was what made him very angry. I wanted to know what the great geneticists and doctors who were practicing intrauterine procedures, IVF and artificial insemination. I wanted to know what the great sociological studies that were being done, the great cultural studies that were being done, the great experimental studies that were being done, and what the statistical studies that were being done. And then I wanted to look at the ethicists and moralists and know how, from the scientific community, not even the Christian community, how they felt about it. And I found such a wealth of material that I was able to relatively easy write 130 pages, bring it down to 90 pages, and still get a lousy grade. Why am I bringing that all up? Is it about Fred? No, it's about academia. You see, because I didn't agree with him, he discounted what I had to say. And he took an argumentative, an antagonistic, a contrary position. It wasn't a discussion. It was an argument. It wasn't even a debate. It was an argument. It was him against me. That's not what higher education is about. And this professor was unworthy to be doing what he did. I think that happens in the area of Christianity all the time. I think people are out there bashing, smashing, and destroying the Christian religion in secular schools, in public schools, and even in religious schools, based upon their prejudice, and because they are in positions of power, and because they're the teachers, and they're the professors, and they're the quote-unquote educators, they can quash any opposition. That's sad, because, you see, what they're doing is just hurting the wholeness of the students who are sitting there. To be a whole student, you have to take into consideration, or I took into consideration what the professor had to say and rejected it. I didn't want to deal with it in my paper. If I wrote a second or a third paper, I might have dealt with it. But I didn't find his class presentations at anywhere near the level of the research I did, so I discounted his material as being inferior to what I was dealing with in the paper. That's my prerogative as the writer of the paper. And you might say, well, that's his prerogative to give you a low grade. Well, not if he's any kind of an educator, it isn't. So we need to, the basis of this whole program is to be talking about the relationship between culture and the church, Western culture mainly, and the church, European Western culture and the church. Mediterranean, North Africans be included in that, in the church. You can see, if you want to, some sub-Sahara influences here because of the great missionary efforts starting in the 15th century. Maybe even some Asian influences, St. Francis Xavier and the like more, if you deal with the Asian complex. A little bit in there. But mainly to say that wholeness comes from knowing from where you come. And what your culture is, what that culture means, and what it has meant in the past, what it actually meant to the people of the time. Not from our viewpoint, but get into their time and understand them from their time. Understand what the complicated, complex situation that they face and why the Christian church was the answer. And then find out what the actual answer, not looking through the dark colored glasses of the 21st century, but looking at it from the aspect of first-hand resources on the ground in the second and fourth and ninth centuries, and then trying to come up with the conclusions as to what that means. How do we get this idea? How do we get the idea that we should take care of each other medically? How do we get the idea that the community should be responsible for the poorest among us? Where do we get the idea that there should be a equality of opportunity? Where do we get the idea that we're born in the image and likeness of God? Where do we get the idea that we hold these truths to be self-evident? Where do we get those ideas? And it wasn't from just Locke and Montesquieu and all those. Those people also got them from the Christian, Judaic, Roman, Greco, and even somewhat Arabic, not Muslim, but Arabic cultures. Not to discount Muslims. Muslims had a piece in there too, but that's another story about how they assimilated the cultures and the Christianity and everything else and turned it into a different form of the same thing. When we do that, we gain a wholeness of identity. And the wholeness of identity will give us the ability to make correct judgments, not fragmented judgments, or not faulty judgments. I'm defining faulty judgments as being judgments based upon less than adequate information, a less than correct interpretations, you know, fair and balanced, to use the Fox News phrasing, if you want to do that. And then from that, the individual who needs to be brought in his lower grades, middle grades, upper grades, college grades, graduate grades, business grades, cultural grades, needs to get that understanding of where he is where is the commonality, where is the community, where is the common core piece that makes him who or she who he or she is. That will bring about, I would suggest to you, a whole person. And when the person is whole, then they can help create whole families, families where open-mindedness and wholeness and the virtues of Christian culture and Christian religion and Christian practice are the center of life. Now, how do we get that today? I would suggest we get that today not only from what I've said thus far, but also by our individual return to the institution called the church. Returning to the church, coming home to the church, and coming home to the church not with the bigotry of higher academic professors, but with the childhood experiences of our early times, confirmation, communion, Sunday school, Christmas plays, Easter pageants, vacation Bible schools, and youth groups, and all that we did or should have experienced, and going back into it with the open-mindedness of maybe a 25 or a 30 or a 40 or even a 50-year-old person, and then listening again to the message of the church, and looking again at the context and the culture of the church, and then evaluating again. And then if we find it to be less than what we wanted, then contributing to making it better, making Christianity a bigger and a better environment and a better expression of what Christ would have it to be. I think that comes in every area. It comes in the area of hospitals. It comes in the area of colleges and universities. It comes in the area of businesses and law firms and the justice system and government, social service agencies and the like. All of these, which have their basic foundational fundamental principles rooted and grounded in Christian culture and Christian faith, need to reevaluate that. Not from a negative, but from a positive standpoint, and then being informed by that, making decisions on how we apply that to making whole persons and whole communities and whole families. Okay, I think I've beaten this thing to death. So we're going to end our program earlier today. I would have a chance to have callers. I have 11 minutes. So if you have an opportunity to call in, and go ahead. The number is 347-215-9968. 347-215-9968. I'll try to work this switchboard here. I might not be able to do it terribly well, but as I said before in previous programs, there's only one guy here. So I hope, if you care to, it's 347-215-9960. I'm down to 6 minutes here, so I don't have that much time to take calls. Sorry about that. Okay, while we're waiting, I don't have much more to say. Why don't we listen to a song? We have another song here. There's a great song here called, let me see if I can find it on this switchboard here. I know I don't have any new songs. I guess I should get new songs. Is that what you're telling me? Yeah. Come Thou Almighty King. Come Thou Almighty King. Kind of a jazzy tune here. It's an older hymn, but it's spruced up a little bit for our time. And if you get a chance, 347-215-9968. Hey, sweetheart. How's it going?
Hi. Are you playing this?
Yeah, I'm playing this. I'm talking on the radio.
This?
Yeah, this is a microphone.
How is it so big? I thought microphones had a little stick and a little tiny stick.
Some of them do have that. This is a big microphone. Radio microphone.
Are you?
Yeah. Yeah. I have to stop a minute now. Just a minute. Don't do that. Don't do that. Hello, this is Pastor Fred, and I'm back. Thank you. We just listened to Come Thou Almighty King. I really love those songs. We're out of time, and I know that we didn't get any callers, and that's okay. I appreciate your listening. If you're listening to this on the archives, I want to thank you for listening to it on the archives. Maybe most listen to it on the archives. I do hope to be able to get back to you a little bit more often, and maybe as we work along a system of give and take, we can find a time that's best. Right now, I broadcast these mostly from 10 to 12 in the morning because that seems to work out with my other employment, but I will try to find a particular time. Maybe that will be the always time, even though I also can broadcast this from 8 to 10. Maybe that's a better time. If you get a chance to give me an email or look up the website or contact me in some other way, I appreciate that. Maybe if you'd like to give a like or on the website here or press the follow button, I'd appreciate that. I'd like to just know that we're doing something meaningful for you. And if we're not, let us know what we're doing that's not meaningful, and maybe we can find a way to improve ourselves and do a better job. Again, this is Pastor Fred. I wanted to thank you for listening, and God bless you. You've been listening to Perspective, a Bible study and Christian commentary program by Frederick Schoenfeld, pastor, doctor, and chaplain, and parent, and just all around good fellow. Take care. God bless.